Да? Now, keep your Bibles open then at Psalm 62. You all have usual sort of A5 sized handout. So even if I get lost, you won't. Now, this psalm, number 62, very much heads towards the last two lines. For you, addressing God, will render to a man according to his work. That's where the psalm is going, isn't it? Must be, because the last two lines. In other words, it's saying, you, God, will give everyone what he or she deserves. In other words, it's heading towards the day of judgment, a bit like world history, really, isn't it, this psalm? I don't know if you've noticed that. So I need to start by asking, are you ready for the day of judgment? Because that's how Psalm 62 ends. It's effectively how our lives and the world ends as well. For you will render to a man according to his work. And yet it's clear when we read through Psalm 62, I hope it was clear from the way I read it anyway, that the content of Psalm 62, for that two-thirds of a verse, and the structure are very much about trusting God. So verses 1 to 4, what do we discover? Well, we see there King David trusting God in the face of enemies. Is that fairly clear? And then in verse 5 to 8, David tells himself and us to trust God because of what God is like. I hope you can all see that. Verses 9 and 10, David reminds us, in complete contrast, how untrustworthy the world is, thinking of people and money. Verses 11 and the beginning of verse 12, David tells us why God is trustworthy, because he's strong and loving. Hopefully that came through very clearly as we read through the psalm. And then, as I say, it ends the end of verse 12, that God will judge us in the light, presumably, of what's been said in the rest of Psalm 62, everything that's gone before, because there are two ways to live. And one of them must be trusting God, obviously, because that seems to be what the psalm is about. And the other way to live, which you could argue is a way to die, of course, is that of not trusting God. And that makes a certain amount of sense, doesn't it? Because although the psalm ends with, for you will render to a man according to his work, we know that faith, trusting God, also produces good works, don't we? So that all hangs together fairly well, in fact, despite that last couple of lines being quite a surprise when we read through the psalm. So presumably we all know all of this, don't we? No surprises so far in what I've said, I don't suppose, at all. But what we tend to forget in the light of this psalm that's all about trusting God is that there are also at least two ways of distrusting God. So if there are two ways to live, trusting God or not, there are at least two ways of distrusting God. And they loom quite large in this psalm. So I gave this one the title, Don't Distrust God, because of the way David approaches this subject and packages the psalm. So both trusting God and distrusting God, they both affect what we do, don't they? Our works. And those are what are going to be assessed on the day of judgment, according to the last line of the psalm. So, and so, I know some of you will hate me for doing this. Let's look at the first heading then. Look at the wind and waves, which I've prefixed with the word don't, or the words don't, you might say. What? You seem to be alluding to Peter on the lake. Have you forgotten that we're doing Psalm 62? This is really annoying as a way to approach this psalm. Don't worry, don't worry. Because we get the first couple of verses in the psalm, "For God alone my soul waits in silence." This is David trusting God, isn't it? "He only is my rock and my salvation." Though David's faith there in God is firm, isn't it? But then after this initial statement that David is trusting in God, David then reveals to us how he sometimes feels. Verse 4, he feels like a leaning wall. Conk. He feels like a tottering fence in risk of falling over. In other words, he's feeling very much like the Apostle Peter in Matthew 14, verse 30, where we read that when Peter saw the wind, he was afraid and began to sink. You remember he took his eyes off Jesus and he looked instead at the wind and the waves. And not surprisingly, he began to sink. And that's the same way that David feels, I think. but he puts it in verse 3 like this. So he's feeling quite like Peter on the Sea of Galilee. And he says, "How long will all of you attack a man to batter him?" You remember the wind and waves were battering the boat on the Sea of Galilee. "Like a leaning wall, a tottering fence." So David's surrounded by enemies and he feels weak and he feels unstable. In verse 4 he says, "They only plan to thrust him down from his high position," speaking of himself. Presumably he feels very vulnerable, because when you're king, you're at the top of the pile and really the only way is downwards, isn't it, if you're king? So he feels very vulnerable, surrounded by all these enemies. And then carrying on in verse 4, he says, "They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse." So he's especially aware that his enemies are sneaky and dishonest, and they're trying to undermine him. And the catch for Peter, the catch for King David, and the catch for us as well, is that actually all this stuff is true. When we look in the mirror and see ourselves like a tottering fence or a leaning wall, or when Peter looks at the wind and the waves and he's threatened with sinking and drowning, well, actually, that was a fair assessment, wasn't it? And when David looks in the mirror, and when we look in the mirror and see what we're really like, that we're about to go down and drown, it's all true, actually, isn't it? So our fears, in some ways, are well grounded. Now, for us, it might be that it's true that, say, the government is godless and powerful and anti-Christian. Or it might be that our sins are big and serious. When we think of ourselves as a tottering fence, a leaning wall, whichever way around it is. And it's true, isn't it? And our church is weak and despised, our finances are wobbly, and our health is dodgy. And we tend to look at all these things. And yes, it's true, they are all pretty flaky, actually. And we look in the mirror and we see this leaning wall, we see this tottering fence, and we look at the wind and the waves, and it's somehow, it's a bit like rabbits being caught in the headlamps, isn't it? We have trouble looking away. And yet looking away from those things is exactly what we must do. Instead, we should do what Peter should have done. We should forcibly look away to Jesus, to our God, to our rock, our salvation, our fortress, as David was doing just verses before, in verses 1 and 2. That's what we must tell ourselves when we find that we look like a tottering fence or a leaning wall. That's what the disciples should have been shouting out to Peter. Look away from yourself. Look away from the wind and waves. Look to Jesus. Why? Well, David tells us, and he's now speaking to us. He's not just speaking to himself, but to us and to other people. So he says in verse 5 of the psalm, "For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence. For my hope is from him." In other words, trust God, yeah? And we need to speak to ourselves when we look in the mirror and see ourselves like a tottering fence or wobbly wall, don't we? And we need to speak to each other as well. which is why we need to have sermons on Psalm 62, I guess. Look at verse 8. Trust in him at all times, O people. We're people, aren't we? So David is telling us, look away from yourselves. Trust in God. Trust specifically in the Lord Jesus Christ. And in order to do that, you must turn your head, even if it involves using a very big spanner or something like that, so that you look away from the wind and the waves, and instead you look to Jesus, and you look to God, our rock, our salvation, and our fortress. Because unless we do that, we're not really trusting him, are we? So that's what's going on, really, in the first half of the psalm. We might say we're trusting God, but actually we're looking at the wind and waves. So the second thing, then, we've actually worked our way down as far as verse 9, in fact, is don't trust God and. Now, you have to read that right. It doesn't say don't trust God. It says don't trust God and. Ellipsis. What is this leg guy on about? Well, let's just have a look at the psalm then, shall we? Verse 9. Those of low estate are but a breath, we read. It actually says those of low estate are only a breath. And he recalls the word for only, does the psalmist, David, that he's used four times previously in this psalm. Not totally obvious in the English, but it is sort of there. You can see it. And it's the word ak for only or alone. So in verse 1, he's already said, for God only my soul waits. That's the same word. Yep. In verse 2 and in verse 6, he says, he only is my rock. That's the same phrase. And in verse 5, it's for God only, O my soul, wait. So that's interesting, isn't it? Why is David recalling these onlys from earlier on in the psalm? And the answer is because we tend to trust God plus instead of trusting God only. So the word only, although we skipped over it and read past it too quickly, is really very important. So verse 9a again, those of low estate are only a breath. What's he saying there? Ordinary people cannot be relied on because they're weak. They're a vapor. They are vanity. It's that word again from the book of Ecclesiastes, as you perhaps all know. So what's going on here? Well, the situation is that because we con ourselves that we are trusting God. That's why we must trust God only. We con ourselves that we are trusting God, but we're not, because we're also trusting in other people. We think we're trusting God, but we're actually trusting in God and other people. And that means we're not really trusting God if we're doing that, you see, isn't it? If you think about that, rather an important point. So we might be trusting in family to love us, friends to love us. We might be trusting in employers. We might say, oh, I'm trusting God. He will give me a good job, or he will allow me to keep my good job, or whatever it is. But in reality, we're actually trusting in our employer or our salary or something like that for a real feeling of security rather than God. Or we might trust in our spouse or our kids for love, or our neighbours for help, or our church, even the government. Some people apparently trust in the government to provide for them and things like that, apparently. So it's not surprising in verse 9 that it says, those of a high estate, government maybe, kings, are a delusion, literally a lie. That's the word we associate with politicians, isn't it, quite easily? Because politicians and powerful people often seem to be liars and cannot be trusted, sadly. I love what it says in the second half of verse 9. It says, in the balances, they go up. You see that? So even if you only put a feather on this side of the balance, and you put a politician or those of high estate on the other side, they still go up. They can be counterbalanced by even a feather, seems to be what the image is in the second half of verse 9. I think he's intending to be funny, or at least insulting anyway. But the bottom line of verse 9 is that whether they're strong or weak, great or small, people, mere human people that is, are untrustworthy. And yet, we tend to trust God and other people. How foolish we are. Notice the setting of Psalm in the Blue Books had the word foolish in there, doesn't it? Now you might say, but surely it's good to rely on friends, on family, on church. These are all good gifts from God, aren't they? Of course, they are, obviously. But the problem is that they can stop us from relying on God himself properly, because they stop us relying on God only if we're not careful. Picture, if you like, and you don't actually have to picture it. You can look at the image, greyish image on your handout of an air-sea helicopter. And you see that in the murk hovering over the sea. The air-sea helicopter is dangling a rope ladder to a man or woman who's overboard and in the ocean and clinging to the flotsam, some wreckage or something like that that happens to float. Now, to be saved or rescued, the man in the sea must not only take hold of the rope ladder, which is obviously very important, and like trusting in God, isn't it? What else has he got to do if he's ever going to be saved? He's got to let go of the flotsam. Not just because flotsam tends to get soggy and sinks, but actually he needs to let go of the flotsam and take hold of God's salvation, like the rope ladder, with both hands if he's going to be saved. Because it's only when we do that that we're really trusting in God alone. And in the same way, we can trust good things and people and persuade ourselves that we're trusting God, when actually we're not. We're still clinging onto this bit of soggy flotsam in the form of other people. I've spoken so far about trusting good things like other people, but the psalm says there are plenty of bad things that we can put our trust in as well, and we shouldn't. So David doesn't want us to put our trust in these things, but he mentions them anyway in verse 10. Put no trust in extortion, set no vain hopes on robbery. Hands up if you're trusting in your own protection racket or burglary business. Oh, nobody. Okay. But you see, we might be trusting in our tax fiddle or some cunning deception about the state of our house roof when we're trying to sell it, or an intermittent fault with our car when we're going to try and eBay it or something like that, which is perhaps similar. So we perhaps think we wouldn't do verse 10, but we might. And verse 10 goes on anyway. If riches increase, don't set your heart on them. And we have to ask ourselves, how many of us are relying on a pension scheme or on even a state pension for security or peace in our lives? Diagnostic question, okay? How would you feel if Rachel Reeves gets so desperate for cash that she raids the state pension? Cancels the triple lock or something like that, you know. Would you say, that's okay, I've got a private pension? Wrong answer, because that probably means you're really trusting in your private pension, not in Rachel Reeves or the state pension. So hopefully we've seen that we must not trust God and anything else. And before that we've seen that we mustn't look at the wind and the waves, or ourselves in a mirror when we look like a tottering fence or a wobbly wall. So what do we need to know instead? We've looked at some don't trusts, haven't we? Well, thirdly, looking at verses 11 and 12 in the psalm, we need to know that strength and something called in the psalm actually chesed, don't worry, it will be explained, come only from God. So we've seen so far that we must trust only in God, ultimately, haven't we? And now we need to know that strength and this thing called chesed come only from God. Okay, let's look at the last couple of verses of the psalm. So David is not making this all up. He says he's heard it from God himself in verse 11. Once God has spoken, twice have I heard this, which is just a poetic way of working up to something. And then he says that power, which is actually literally strength, belongs to God. So this verse is saying that strength only really comes from God. That's what the half a verse is saying. Strength only really comes from God. True strength that can be relied on only comes from God. So if you feel like that leaning wall or that tottering fence, verse 3, well, you need some strength to rely on. Where are you going to get some strength? Well, strength only comes from God. Okay, so that's part of the problem, isn't it? What about when you realise that actually you're trusting in people or money or pensions to feel loved or secure? Well, actually, you need God's hesed, God's what? I hear you cry. I didn't actually hear anybody say it. I got the odd slightly puzzled look. Now, as Sean is telling us this morning, the Bible had to be translated from its original languages into English for us to read it, understand it, hear it preached, and believe it and be saved. And so we're really very, very grateful to possibly the greatest Bible translator into the English language anyway, William Tyndale. There's a biography of him, if anyone would like to have a look at that, possibly even borrow it. I think it's got my name in it. And Sean was talking about William Tyndale this morning in the children's talk, wasn't he? Because 500 years ago was when Tyndale was in Cologne and made his first attempt at printing the New Testament in English. Now, he got raided and shut down and all that sort of thing. And later he got killed, and he nearly translated the whole Bible. He did sort of three quarters or something like that. And then he got martyred. Poor man. But he was doing something that it was worthwhile getting martyred for, and that was translating the Bible from the original languages into English. And so Tyndale bumped into words like this Hebrew word, chesed, and thought, I wonder what that means. And he did some research, and it's actually here in the psalm. We'll look in verse 12. It says that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love. Now, Tyndale hadn't got an ESV. Surprise, surprise. They hadn't been invented in 1525, 500 years ago, this very season at least. Anyway, and so he did some research and he discovered that there's no English word that means quite the same as hesed. All the English words have a more concise meaning, a sort of less complicated, a simpler, more focused meaning. But as you can see from your handout, this Hebrew word hesed has a wide range of meaning, and sometimes it seems to mean all of it at the same time as well. It's one of these really big, important words that you get in the Hebrew Bible. So it means some combination of mercy, steadfast love, as your ESV has, loyalty, kindness, covenant faithfulness. So Tyndale was there in Cologne. Well, no, I think he was actually somewhere else when he bumped into the word chesed in the Pentateuch. And he thought, how am I going to translate this into English? I need a suitable word. And he was a clever guy. So do you know what he did? He invented a new English word. And that English word was loving kindness, which is a lovely word, isn't it? And you can see how he's trying to capture a good chunk of the meaning of mercy, steadfast love, loyalty, kindness, covenant, faithfulness, can't you? In loving kindness. So sometimes he translated it loving kindness, sometimes he translated it mercy. And so his use of this word loving kindness found its way into Coverdale's Bible. He published Tyndale's work with some of his own as a whole English Bible. Also translated from the original languages. That found its way into the Great Bible, which you've perhaps heard of, the King James Bible that most of you will have owned at least one of, I imagine, at some point, and even newer translations like the New American Standard Bible. They have loving kindness in them, and that came from Tyndale. The ESV uses steadfast love, but they're trying to do the same thing, really, aren't they, as Tyndale did. But they invented a phrase rather than a word, and you get steadfast love 195 times in your English ESV translation. And as I say, Tyndale sadly was martyred before he got as far as translating Psalm 62. But Coverdale finished it off for him. So in the Coverdale Bible, 1535, I've printed it on your handout, how he rendered the beginning of verse 12 of the psalm, that thou, Lord, with an E, art merciful, with two L's. So he went for the merciful angle on this word, hesed. But however you look at it, this mercy, this hesed, this steadfast love, this loyalty, this kindness, this divine covenant faithfulness doesn't come from ordinary people. It only comes from God. It can't be bought. It can't be stolen. It only comes from God. So merciful, steadfast, kind and faithful love, what we really, really need, comes only from God. And then you remember, only he has real strength. And those are the two things that we need. Strength and chesed, loving kindness of your William Tyndale. So that's what the psalm teaches us. First two points being negatives, of course. And the third one being what the psalm is really about and why we must trust God. So if we are to be found righteous on the day of judgment, which is where this psalm is heading, remember, the last line or two of the psalm, our life choices must not be based on our trust of mere other people, must they? Nor must our actions reveal that actually it's money or something like that that we trust. Still less must we deceive ourselves that we are trusting God when we're actually also clinging on to some flotsam wreckage that we're refusing to let go of, be it people, money, or whatever it is, in addition to God. And what we ultimately need then, and hopefully want eternally, is God's strength and his hesed, his loving kindness, mercy, steadfast love, loyalty, covenant, faithfulness. You perhaps know that Scully and his team down in Brighton really like their version of the Bible they use, the Christian Standard Bible, which used to be really odd. But nowadays, when you look at it, it's pretty sensible and mainstream, you might say. And I put on your handout how the Christian Standard Bible translates the end of verse 11 in the psalm, the beginning of verse 12. If you look at your handout, you can see that. That strength belongs to God, which I think is better than power belongs to God. And then verse 12, and faithful love belongs to you, still addressing God. And you can see what they're doing, can't you? They're trying to translate this word hesed, the thing that we most need and that we can only get from our God. What does this all look like in practice? Well, the Apostle Paul is very practical, so come with me to 1 Timothy 6, verses 17 to 19. Again, I printed it on your handout. Probably good for you to look in your real Bibles, wakes you all up, but nevertheless, it is there on your handout. And he says, as for the rich in this present age, remember the rich that we shouldn't be trusting, those who are highborn, charge them, these are rich Christians, not to be haughty, not to be arrogant, nor to set their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God. So Paul's saying the same thing as the psalm, isn't he? Who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. And then he moves on to our behaviour in verse 18. He says, there to do good and to be rich in good works, because you see, they're not trusting money, they're trusting only God. To be generous and ready to share, which you won't do if you're trusting money, but you're freed up to do that if you're trusting only God, of course. Thus, storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future. So I think he's alluding there to the Day of Judgment. So that they may take hold of that which is truly life. So really living, true life, according to the Apostle Paul, is about relying on God's strength and his loving kindness, as Tyndale would have put it in his word choice, and living our lives in the light of God's strength and God's hesed. Amen.